So I'm happy to introduce our next speaker now, Scott Reeves. So after coming to General Insurance via superannuation and life insurance 20 years ago, Scott landed an actuarial role in a commercial insurance team, which provided the ideal environment for him to understand the value of blending actuarial science with a broader, more commercial outlook. Between 1999 and 2006, Scott expanded into reinsurance, working at St Paul Re, Employers Re and Swiss Re, where he moved from actuary to underwriting, becoming the Asia Pacific casualty lead. 2012 saw Scott commence with Munich Re in the role of underwriting manager, casualty, and is now the head of underwriting, where he is responsible for all lines of business across treaty and facultative for Australia and New Zealand markets. So please join me in welcoming Scott.
Back to the phone call we had the other day, and we were talking about the order of who's going to speak. And I said, sure, I'll follow Tim, no problems at all. Following and consulting actually with a ton of data, that's what I really want to do. So, let's start. First of all, this is my personal view. Okay, this does not represent the views of Munich Re, though Munich Re does take the view that in order to solve some of these problems, which are quite intractable, governments, communities, insurers need to work together. Now, that said, what I'll also point out is I am somewhat deliberately expressing some extremist views about pools. They are decidedly positive because they're going to balance off against what John's going to say. Feel free to disagree. Feel free to hurl things at the stage. Hopefully, if we generate enough discussion, it'll be interesting. Where I'd like to begin is there's a chapter in the Hart Buchanan and Howe actuarial textbook, and this shows my age straight away. And this story stuck with me. So quite simply, there was a village where 20 farmers had haystacks, and the haystacks would burn down, and it came around, how do we deal with this? And Hart Buchanan and Howe said, okay, principle number one, insurance is the transfer of the variation of a risk from the insured to the insurer. Excellent. Right. And it goes on and talks about some of the other risk pricing mechanisms, but it also says there was a different village down by the river. And this problem with this village is the grass was really green and lush and moist. And when that village's farmers created their haystacks, the haystacks were too moist and inevitably burst into flames because of the heat generated. And this is the problem because the number of claims that this kind of little community pool had established exploded. And the premium for each farmer had to increase because of this new experience. But many of the original farmers said, hang on, why do we have to pay more just because the farmers down there lose so many haystacks? Now, the response of this little allegory was, well, those guys should get charged six times what we get charged. So it kind of comes back to Tim's point. And the principle that Hart Buchanan and Howe said was different insured risks do not present the same degree of risk. So this is kind of the jump-off point. And I have to say this story really stuck with me the whole time since I studied this, which possibly suggests I didn't do much paying attention to the rest of the book, but I stopped at chapter one. But anyway. It's been said today the reality is we're getting really, really good at risk level pricing. By the way, let's remind ourselves that companies, whether listed or otherwise, companies have a duty to their shareholders. And I come back to this towards the end because this is driving everything. The demand for profit growth coupled with what we can now do with the data, and Tim showed admirably the level of data we have, and this is all being put into frontline pricing. And certainly, as Tim showed, includes peril pricing. Now, at the risk of saying exactly what Tim said, I thought I'd come at it slightly differently. So I just randomly went into Google Maps and found an address in Windsor, I found an address in Townsville, and I checked my own house and then got quotes from a few insurers. And I put this not in dollar terms, but in relative terms to the median house value in these suburbs, and also the median income of these suburbs to match CIFA. Actually, what really jumps out here is the obvious. I'm in a great socioeconomic group, and I get to pay less than pretty much everybody else. What's stunning is in Windsor, you see the price there of almost 10% of median income, and in Townsville, 15%. And I'm kind of pleased with that because it maps sort of 15% looks like 7.5 weeks payback of annual income, so I'm not too far away from what Tim said. So far, I'm safe ground. In two cases, by the way, and different insurers, the website refused to provide a quote, which didn't so much surprise me, but still, that's not helpful if you're trying to get a quote. And you have to then ask, what's the affordability where you're being asked to pay 15%? Now, by the way, anybody who pauses for about a second will tear holes in the seeming conclusions I've presented. Of course, this house may not have been the median house. Of course, the person who could afford such a house may not have got the median income. I'm neatly going to ignore all of those challenges and say it's self-evident. But it comes to the problem of what happens when people cannot or will not insure. So I went a different way, and I just searched, determinedly so, on news.com.au and said, search for not insured, devastated as a result of cyclone, whatever. And these are actual quotes. So these are lifted from the website. The one message that keeps coming out is the implied or explicit desire for society to provide justice. And justice can be construed however you want, but there is somebody who's saying, I've lost everything, I did not have insurance, never mind why I chose not to buy insurance, but I didn't have insurance and I've lost nothing. And we get pictures of dreadful families who are in tears and the heartstrings are being pulled, and the community gets to come together and say, we must help these people. And they turn to the government, who says, yes, we must help these people. The problem I have is the chain of events that lead to people being unable or unwilling to purchase insurance lead to public charity as a backstop. And it's not a great conclusion. So, what to do about it? Let's go for a bit tangentially at the moment. The government is already involved when disaster hits. And I'm deliberately starting with the Bureau of Meteorology here. So the infrastructure they've got is used all over the place. The EMA, the Emergency Management Australia, and this is just some blurb for the one or two people who didn't know it, I didn't. So this is a division within the Attorney General's Department, leads disaster and emergency management, works with state and territory governments and international bodies, and maintains our national security and the emergency management capability. Importantly, the EMA coordinates the government support, both physical and financial. So, key word there. Further, the government Australia established the Australian Institute for Disaster Resilience. This is the AIDR, to implement the National Strategy for Disaster Resilience. And the EMA is also home to the Crisis Coordination Centre, which 24/7 all hazards provides situational awareness for decision making during a crisis and also coordinates the physical assistance during the disasters. So we know at the state and local levels the government's involved or being talked to about mitigation, about resilience, but in a hands-on context, the federal government is deeply involved in disasters. And then it came to the question of, and remember, I'm talking pro pools. So let's jump to the end, and I'm going to say right now, a pool is a really good idea to assist those who would not otherwise take insurance by financing the risk that they can't afford. So you now know the end of the story. The question comes to, at least I asked, what's the role of government? And by the way, if anybody can search, what does the Australian government see as its role? Please let me know, because I couldn't find it. It's not actually good at telling you what it's there to do. It will tell you how it's going to do it, and the Constitution sets out the structural means it's going to do it, but I couldn't find a snappy little thing as, this is what we're here for. So instead, I came across a group called the Australian Collaboration, and they hit the nail on the head, which is why I put it here, by the way. So a government should provide economic framework, and it should act to alleviate the negative impacts of the marketplace on individuals. Now, that's my choice of what to highlight. Again, it suits my argument. I'm really good. I'm learning from my wife how to argue, so I'm only going to focus on the things that help me. But the Australian Collaboration talks about the infrastructure required to carry out the functions of government, utilities, water, electricity, stuff like that. And sure, it talks about private consortia could be used to build and manage some of these facilities, but ultimately the infrastructure will nearly always need to remain in public ownership. And whilst corporations play important functions in modern economies, and they offer opportunities for innovation, and enterprise is really good at driving economic growth, we know about corporate social responsibility coming into the minds of corporations. I don't know to what degree it's truly in the DNA versus something you probably should think about, so you've got talk about at your annual general meeting. But still, how much is this influencing business activity? Ultimately, the state is responsible for ensuring the quality of life of its citizens, the fairness of society, and the quality of the physical environment. That's what the Australian Collaboration concluded, and happy to say I agree. So we come now to the so what. The affordability is seeing some individuals, and I got the similar numbers for as Tim did on 5 to 10% of uninsurance. So some individuals are unable or unwilling to protect themselves. You have a current involvement of the government in all levels of natural disaster, and you have a question about what is the role of government. And as I've shown before, it suits me to say the role is to provide social utility. Now, this takes me back to basically year 9 commerce. I like trains. I like catching the train to work. But I can't afford a train myself, and I can't afford to build a rail network. So it makes sense for the government to do that. But if it charged me what it actually cost them, I probably couldn't afford a ticket daily. Now, despite the fact that some government business enterprises are losing track of whether they're profit-making or utility, I firmly believe the role of government is to provide social utility, which leads us to pools. My view is, so what I'm going to propose to you here as a concept is that the creation of a pool in alleviating the affordability question is there to allow society to derive utility. Now, when I say utility, what I mean is a financial or otherwise benefit that's not easily bounded and estimated, but you know some good is going on. There's a reason for it happening. But fundamentally, and here's my left-leaning characteristics coming out, what I propose is that a pool runs at a deficit. It should not collect premiums equal to the risk it accepts. And reason why the pool funded by the marketplace wouldn't work, or by commercial insurance wouldn't work, is because we have a duty to our shareholders, as I said, to actually charge the right risk according to the exposures we take on. What I'm proposing is a government, because it has the ability to tax and spread a deficit over time, should have the role of charging less than the true cost. Now, in doing so, it can then begin to address that question about this backstop of social charity that I talked about. So we're now going to be in a situation where if we've taken on the risk of people who have an affordability problem, an intractable affordability problem, it's then taken a lot of that out, and it's doing so explicitly. It can now say this is how much it's costing. I suspect, by the way, and this is unfounded and I'm open to challenge, in thinking about this, I suspect a government would say, I have a limitless number of demands for what to do. I have a finite revenue pool from which to meet it. I have to prioritise. That's no big surprise. But in doing so, when I think about, do I put money aside for mitigation, for resilience, for something like this, it may be easier. It may be easier for the government to say, look, let's not go through budgetary committees and try to get 20 million, as Rob said, or perhaps a billion as the right number could be, pre-funded and ready to go, meaning we can't afford something else. That's not overly sexy. But when a disaster hits, we can come out in the face of public cry out and say, I tell you what, how about we put $15 million aside for these poor people who've been affected, and won't we look like good guys? We didn't have to have an argument in a committee, and we look good in the media. That's possibly an easier sell. The other thing, and this is crucial too, it's not just all about running at a deficit and saving everybody from having to spend money on insurance, is you now have a real role for the government to link back to re-establishing building codes for better resilience, dealing with mitigation, and arguably, by having an explicit cost through its own accounts, it now has a real motivation to get active on some of these things of resilience and mitigation. Otherwise, it's a disconnected argument. But I don't propose that a pool is perfect, nor is it always going to work. There are some areas where insurance companies do very, very well, and one of them, for example, is the resource planning. Their ability to carry resources through the year and to ramp up. I don't see the governments necessarily always succeeding at that. And also the procurement strategies that insurers are now getting so good at of working with JB Hi-Fi or the good guys. They know roughly how many washing machines and fridges are going to need in the aftermath of some of these disasters. And there remains, of course, the unanswered question, I have to say, about what's the behavioural impact of simply taking the risk off somebody. Unless and until, this is impossible, by the way, unless and until the government can say, okay, we've provided the means of taking this unaffordable risk off you. That means if you choose not to buy insurance, when the disaster hits, don't go crying about, I've lost everything and I didn't have insurance, because you had the opportunity to do so. Yeah, that's not going to happen. That's still going to... Yeah. So I don't have an answer to the behavioural impact. So finally, what I'd like to leave you with is just my view of what a structural suggestion could look like. So covering government pool versus a private cover, providing that cover below cost, that's number one. But the operations of that pool, when it comes to a disaster, could be managed by the private market. I think there's elements where they do that better. Key thing is the government runs at a deficit, but that's included in the budgets. So the government has to explicitly recognise what it's doing and match up tax revenues. In other words, it's having to face some tough discussions and actually show leadership. Anyway, let's take it as a conceptual. But that then flows through to the government can also have explicit linked discussions about mitigation. And then we come to the role where insurers and reinsurers could play a role, which is dealing with extremes. I'm not suggesting the government has to cover a 1-in-1,000-year event, but through their own costings, they can leverage, at the right price, the reinsurance markets to smooth out some of these extremes. Now, this is, of course, decidedly left-leaning, so I apologise. It's a very pro-pool. But I think that as a concept, I think it's a good jump-off point to start an argument. So that's it.